Okay, so today's Taisho is case number 30 of the Mumonkan, Mind Itself, Buddha Itself. I'll read out the case. Daibai asked Basso, "What is Buddha?" And Basso answered, "Mind Itself, Buddha Itself." Mumon's commentary. If you grasp it on the spot, you wear Buddha's clothes, eat Buddha's food, speak Buddha's words, do Buddha's deeds, you are Buddha himself. Though this may be so, Daibai has also misled not a few people into mistaking the mark on the balance for the weight itself. How can he realize that even the mere mention of the word Buddha should make a man rinse his mouth for 3 days? If one is such a man, when he hears someone say, "Mind is Buddha," he will cover his ears and run away. Then Mumon wrote a verse. The blue sky, the broad daylight, it is most detestable to hunt around. If furthermore you ask, "What is Buddha?" it is like shouting your innocence while holding the lute. There's a beautiful koan. It's a very famous koan and also a very famous master. So here we have the master here is, of course, Matsu in Chinese, or Basso. And just a little bit on Basso. Basso was a student of the fifth patriarch Hongren. So he was born 709 to 788, so 79 years old. So just get a handle on that. So this was all, you know, this all happened, or supposedly happened, between that time, between 709 to 788, let's say maybe 750, or whenever that was. So, you know, you're talking really a long, long time ago. And nevertheless, you know, we still ask ourselves in many ways the same question. You know, we're all here asking ourselves that same question. That has been asked not just in the 700s, but even before then. I'll get back to that in a minute. Just on the master here, Master Basso, two schools trace themselves to Basso, Matsu. It gets a little bit confusing sometimes because some literature have the Chinese names and some have the Japanese names. So you have to get your head around that. It's all good for mental development, but it gets a bit confusing. First, he studied with Nan Yue. Some of you may know Nan Yue, Master Nan Yue, is the brick, polishing the brick. That koan, I gave a teisho on that a while. And then after 10 years, he received Dharma transmission. In other words, he was approved as someone that has seen the Dharma, someone that has had awakening. He then settled into a hermitage, and he's reported to have stayed there for many, many years practicing Chikantaza. You know. And he became famous according to the Chinese Heritage Book, which is it's quite an interesting book, which chronicles the Zen masters in the Tang Dynasty, looks at the sayings that were attributed to those masters, and also gives you some biography on them. Anyway, according to what I'm reading here, a famous official, if you like, became a student of Basso, and made him famous. And so he then attracted a lot more students because of that as well. So he became a very, very, very important figure in Zen. The other thing that's interesting about him is that he emphasized the immediacy of awakening. So as you know, in Zen, there are these two branches. One is like the immediacy, in other words, having an immediate awakening experience, meaning that it's an event that happens when you have an awakening experience, and it's unmistakable. It shifts something in our brain, if you like, and we all of a sudden transcend duality. We call that Kensho, or there are many names for this. But the other one, you know, that is mainly practiced also in the Soto lineage, They see that as just ordinary, that's just an ordinary phenomenon. And that's called the gradual school. And in the gradual school, it's through sitting and through practice, we gradually attain the wisdom that we get through also the sudden part. In itself, having a sudden experience, it's just that, a sudden experience. What matters more than anything is what we get out of it. It's the integration of it. So it's the insights that we get and how do we actually apply this insight in our day-to-day life. Ultimately, that's what it's about. You know, these other ones are just steps to get to those insights. You know, otherwise, just having an experience in itself, well, it, you know, what's it good for? You know, we can ask ourselves, what's it good for? You know, so anyway, there's always been these debates within Zen. What is the better way, the gradual or the sudden? And you all know my answer to that is it's always gradual until it's sudden. You know, it's like it happens eventually. It doesn't really matter in one way. You know, the speed of it happens in its own way. But more importantly is the insights that we get from that. Okay, so that was Master Basso. So here then we have a monk asking Basso. So that monk's name is Daibai, and he asked a question. What is Buddha? And Basso answered, mind itself, Buddha itself. So just a little bit on Daibai. He was born 752 to 839, disciple of Basso, as was Nansen, by the way, and Baizang, or Hakyusho. You may know Hakyusho and the fox and Nansen's cats. I mean, they were all disciples of Basso. So anyway, Daibai, he had an early ordination, and he took the precepts at age 20. So taking the precepts means becoming a Buddhist, formally becoming a Buddhist. That's what it is. So age 20. And apparently he was really well versed in the sutras. And the other thing that is that it says you know, in the Chronicles here is that he's supposed to have had a really great memory. So for whatever that's worth. So Daibai apparently, there's a story about Daibai and this particular koan. Daibai had an experience when he heard Basso say, when he asked him that question, what is Buddha? And Daibai is supposed to have said, mind itself, Buddha itself. So that's what the koan is about. And at that moment he had a shift when he heard that. You know, it used to be mind is Buddha, because they have changed the translation. It's quite interesting. If you go into the koan, it's quite often you look at a koan that you worked on, and all of a sudden the translation has changed. So if you look at the website where all the koans are, quite often that happens. And so what happens is someone decides, oh, that translation doesn't really capture it, so I'll give it another translation. That's what happened here. So instead of saying mind is Buddha, probably Migaku did this. Someone translated as mind itself, Buddha itself, you know. So anyway, let's not get too caught up on the translations. And they are important, but they're also not important at all. And I'll explain that in a minute. So what happened was, when Daibai heard that, he is reportedly to have gone into a solitary hermitage, and he started practicing Shikantaza. Shikantaza is a Japanese word for just sitting. Okay, just sitting. Explain a little bit more about that later on. Just sitting. And what happened, as it happened quite often in China, monks traveled and went to seek out different other monks. This happened also in Thailand, and it happened in various other Southeast Asian countries. So people, after certain experiences, go and see other masters. They go and experience. They want to see, you know, they want to experience someone else beyond their own master. You know, in our tradition, you usually spend some time with one teacher, and then you go out and you test yourself with other teachers. And that's what Daibai did as well. Right now, we have Jack in the United States with Upaya doing exactly that. You know, so she's, you know, I remember when I was at Sun Mountain Zen, I you know, went to Kamakura, and you know, I wanted to see the Roshi face to face, have Dokusan, see what that was like, and just compare him with my teacher. So this is it's a tradition that has survived. It has survived. Now, of course, it's much easier. We've got Zoom, and we've got we can just dial in. In many ways, it's too easy. You know, there's just so many teachers we have access to nowadays that in itself can belittle our search to some degree, depending on how much confusion there is out there. Okay, so anyway, this monk went there, and he confronted Daibai. This other monk confronted Daibai, and he said, "So what did you get?" And he said, "I got mind is Buddha from my teacher, and I've been practicing with that ever since. Mind is Buddha." So then he went back and he said to Basso, "Oh, Basso, you know, there's this guy out there that says mind is Buddha." And Basso said, "I wonder whether that's Daibai. Wonder whether that's old Daibai. He had an experience about it." So anyway, he sent another monk to check Daibai out to see whether that was him. And this other monk went over to see Daibai again, and he said, "Well, you know, were you a student of Basso's?" And Daibai said, "Yes." He says, "Mind is Buddha is what Basso teaches." He says, "No, he doesn't. He's changed his teaching," this monk said. He said, "What does he teach now?" He said, "No mind, no Buddha." And Daibai is supposed to have said, "That old fool still confuses people. As far as I'm concerned, it is just this mind is Buddha." You know. So anyway, that's the story here. And the monk then went back and reported this back to Basso, and Basso said, "The plum has ripened." That was his response to this. The plum, and apparently, Daibai in Chinese, there's something to do with plum. It says the plum has ripened. You know. He's seen beyond, this is Buddha, mind is Buddha, only Buddha. He's seen beyond it. You know, this is what that refers to. Okay, so a little bit about this. Now, when I looked at this Taisho, and of course this is a very short koan, you know, Daibai asked Basso, "What is Buddha?" Basso answered, "Mind itself, Buddha itself." It can't get shorter than that. We hear quite often, you know, in koans, you know, a question like, "What is Buddha? What is mind?" You know, and then a monk or a teacher gives an answer. So quite a lot of koans, you know, are in that genre, if you like. And I myself, as I've mentioned a few times, you know, I had an experience similar to that. But the question wasn't, "What was Buddha?" At the time, I was a Christian. It was, What is God? What is God? I didn't ask that question, but certainly that was my quest. You know, I mean, what is this Christianity all about? Or what is this Buddhism all about? Or, you know, that was my quest, you know. And I remember very vividly this teacher saying to me, and he wasn't a priest or anything, he said, "But Arno, don't you realize you are God?" You know. And that was a moment where for that moment, there was no separation. That was enough. That was enough of an experience for me to get a taste of what it's like to have no separation between me and God, or me and Buddha. And once that happens, you cannot undo that. It's impossible to undo. And the consequences of that are incredibly profound. You know, a shift happens, even though that is only very momentary. A shift happens, and at that moment, that through a stupid question like that, it just, the separation vanquishes. And that's something that is what is meant by sudden awakening, or sudden, doesn't mean you're enlightened or anything, but it's a sudden shift of our conceptual separation is all of a sudden gone for that instant. So this is the same thing right here. So we can look at these things intellectually without getting that shift, and that misses it. But nevertheless, that's all we've got. So if we haven't had that shift, we haven't had that shift. So we keep going. You know? So we have maybe we might get an intellectual understanding of that. But this Daiba, he had a shift happening when that happened. Then he went on and he continued his practice. So the question, we all come here with a question, or we all come here with a purpose. We all come here with, we want something. Now, we might not necessarily want to know what Buddha is. That might be too esoteric for a lot of people. We might not necessarily want to know what God is, you know. But we might want to know, what is peace? I want to know what peace is. Or what is, how can I go beyond anxiety? Or what is Zen? You know, the label is exactly the same. The question is exactly the same. It's the questions of all questions. What is Mu? Same question. What is Buddha? What is it actually that I, what do I want to sit here for? What is it actually I want in life? What, that is the question, what is Buddha? So please, swap that around. It doesn't have to be Buddha, it can be something else. You know, whatever it is you're searching, you might not even know what it is. Whatever it is that we are somehow intuitively not getting, or we want to grasp it somehow, that's what this is about. Okay. And, you know, Matsu said, mind itself, Buddha itself, mind itself, Buddha itself. That was his answer. Mind itself, Buddha itself. Now, when I looked at his biography, because I always like to give a little bit of biography about who this Matsu is, I noticed that he actually wrote something about this. So this is some writing that was attributed to Matsu. Whether it is or not, of course, it's so long ago, we don't know that. But let's presume it is. Chinese kept good records. And this is what he wrote, and I've got it on the back of this sheet here. So I'm going to go through that because it's very, very good. And it's better getting it out of his mouth than my mouth. So this is what he wrote about this. Okay. One day, Matsu addressed the congregation. So obviously he had a lot of students there or monks, and he addressed the congregation saying, all of you here believe that your own mind is Buddha. That in itself, I mean, we can so quickly read that and go past that, okay, that my own mind is Buddha. But if you really get that, you've got to get the consequences of this. That means that your own mind is everything. Your own mind is Buddha. Whatever you're searching, remember I just said, your own mind is peace. Your own mind is God. Your own mind is whatever it is you're searching for. That's what he's saying. Your own mind is Buddha. I mean, everyone is searching for Buddha in this Buddhist context. But whatever we are, whatever context we are living in, your own mind, so it's your own mind, that is it. Okay. This very mind is Buddha mind. This very mind is Buddha mind. And when I read this, what comes to me immediately is this very mind is Buddha mind, is there is no other. It's just that I alone. You know, this very mind is Buddha mind. There is nothing other than my mind. There's nothing other than my mind. Okay. When Bodhidharma came from India to China, he transmitted the supreme vehicle teaching of one mind. So one mind here means no separation. Entering a consciousness where I don't separate anymore. You know, I am totally, I see the whole thing at once. No separation. That's what Bodhidharma, and that's what he called the supreme vehicle. The supreme vehicle really means Mahayana. Mahayana, Maha means great or supreme. Yana means vehicle. Mahayana Buddhism is the supreme vehicle. Okay. The other one used to be called the lesser vehicle or Hinayana, which we don't refer to anymore because it can be seen as derogative. But there are differences. There are differences in methods. And as I mentioned before, in the Mahayana, the method is very much from this teaching from this one mind perspective. Not so much how to get there is, but you've already got it. It's letting go. It's that whole practice of letting go. So please see one mind. And in order to see one mind, it is letting go. What are we letting go of? Other. Always other. What is other? Letting go of chair, letting go. Whatever object of meditation, whatever object arises, oh, there's a lovely breeze, let go. Let go. There is no separation. Let go. That's how we practice it. But eventually we come to a point where we see it. There is no other. That demands nothing less than a complete letting go, of course, of self, which is the self is that's continuously separating. Our self is the part that separates. So, okay, so this very mind is Buddha mind. When Buddha Dharma, of course, most people know Bodhi Dharma is accredited as being the first ancestor that came from India to from India to China to transmit Zen, okay, to transmit that direct pointing, if you like. So that's what he's referring to, the Bodhi Dharma. When this very mind is Buddha mind, when Bodhi Dharma came from India to China, he transmitted the supreme teaching of one mind, allowing people like you to attain awakening. Allowing people like you, like we are here, even right now, 2024, you know, still feasting on Bodhi Dharma's transmission, if you like, allowing people like us, you know, allowing people like us to attain awakening. We're still dealing with the same subject matter. Moreover, it goes on, he brought with him the text of the Lankavatara Sutra, using it as the seal of the mind ground of sentient beings. So the Lankavatara Sutra is quite a famous sutra in the Yogacara tradition. But that's all it is. It is a sutra, and it explains emptiness and form, and it goes into various things, and a lot of the stuff that is being taught here and that we realize through koan practice that we do is in the Lankavatara Sutra. Okay. So in those days, what was important was, you know, you need to somehow, and again, I mentioned that a few times in the past, you need to somehow have some legitimacy. And like even now, what gives Zen its legitimacy? What does give Buddhism its legitimacy? Something has to be, what gives science its legitimacy? Something has to be there that we can say, yes, that is the real thing. In science, it's hypothesis and thesis and conclusions and that whole academic world that somehow does referencing, and we have a whole system where you can say, yep, that is pure research, this is legitimate. And it's the same in religion. What does religion have that gives religion its legitimacy? It's the Bible in the Christian world, it's the Quran in the Muslim world. That is the object of legitimacy. In the Buddhist world, it is the sutras, you know. It is the sutras in some traditions, not in Zen. In Zen, what gives us the legitimacy is Dharma, capital D, the way it is, being able to see it, being able to see what is in the sutras for ourselves, being able to experience it. Okay. But that is what gives legitimacy in Zen. It's like the Dharma transmission. That's why there is a lineage, you know, that. That is what gives it its legitimacy. I don't know if some of you get the Tricycle magazine, but in the Tricycle magazine, they've just announced the winner for the haiku. Haiku is a poem style, a Japanese style of poetry. And it's complex, as in it can only be so many words and syllables and what have you. Anyway, the winner is just, when I read that, it's just magnificent. Magnificent. And to me, this haiku, I'm going to read it out in a minute, this haiku points exactly to the whole of Buddhism, to the whole of what Zen is all about. In a few words, it just bang goes straight to it. To me, that's another form of legitimacy. It's not so much the words, but getting it, and that whoever wrote that, they got it, and they, you know, and reading it, even as someone that reads it, you could access it, just by reading it, you access it, and at that moment, that is legitimacy. Anyway, this Jan Hall is her name, and she wrote this. Outside my window, it keeps reciting itself, the Snowflake Sutra. Outside my window, it keeps reciting itself, the Snowflake Sutra. Now, you look at the sutras, or you look at the Bible, you know, and all these writings, outside my, or I could say, in my car, it keeps driving itself, the driving sutra. In the Zendo, it keeps reciting itself, the Teisho Sutra. I need to completely disappear to realize that everything keeps on reciting itself. The whole, all phenomena in itself. And I mean, how close is this to, you know, to this mind is Buddha? Or mind itself, Buddha itself, everything in itself, you know, keeps on reciting itself. You know, anyway, I thought it was a fantastic sutra. And I feasted on this many times, you know, in the shower, you know. The Shower Sutra is cleaning itself. It's beautiful. You know. Please get out of the way and experience the sutra. This is what this is all about. So, you know, anyway, few words, and it, to me anyway, it really points to it. Okay. So, moreover, he brought with him, this is Bodhidharma, the text of the Lankavatara Sutra, using it as the seal of the mind ground, so as a foundation, you know, of sentient beings. He feared that your views would be inverted and you wouldn't believe in the teaching of this mind that each and every one of you possesses. Therefore, Bodhidharma brought the Lankavatara Sutra, which offers the Buddha's words that mind is the essence. Mind is the essence. Mind is the essence. So nothing happens without mind. Nothing is there without mind. We get to that in a minute. And there is no gate by which to enter Dharma. If you see this, if you see that there is only mind, how can there be a gate? If there is no separation, if there is no separation, how can there be a gate to enter? There is no such thing as a gate. Of course, we create these gates. You know, that's why I call it the gateless gate. We create these gates. And koans are means to dissolve the duality that we continuously create, the separation that we continuously create. So koans are there as a means to dissolve them for us, to integrate them. You who seek Dharma should seek nothing, goes on. So this is, what happens is, we seek something. We want something. We can even make something out of nothingness. If we say, oh, okay, I've got to get something. Or I've got to get nothing. And then we've just created something. We said, well, because we make it, we make nothing as something, you know. So that you who seek Dharma, you who seek it, you know, who seek Dharma, the way things are, that clarity, that where there is no separation, you who seek that, you know, should seek nothing. Because as soon as you seek something, you bang, there's separation. There's separation. So in our sitting practice, this is really fundamental, you know, just sitting with whatever is occurring. Sitting with whatever is occurring. Happiness, sadness, cold, hot, whatever is occurring. 1 minute I add something, the next minute I don't. Then I say, oh, I shouldn't be doing that. Then I say, oh, no, this is good, this is bad. It's just unfolding as it does. No judgments. Just, and if we judge, well, it's just a judgment as it is occurring. You who seek Dharma should seek nothing. Apart from mind, there is no other Buddha. that there is no other Buddha. Apart from mind, there is no other. You don't even have to say Buddha. Apart from mind, there is no other. Apart from Buddha, there is no other mind. Apart from Buddha, there is no other mind. So even if I say chia, you know, sorry, that there is actually, that comes in later. But anyway, even if I say chia, you know, for me to be able to say there's a chia there, you know, I need my mind. Without mind, there is no chia. You know, I need my mind in order to say chia. Do not grasp what is good nor reject what is bad. Do not grasp what is good and do not reject what is bad. So of course we tend to fixate on the good, maybe sometimes on the bad, and we hold on to it. So the idea here is to continuously let go. So it's a practice of letting go. We are continuously letting go, not fixating. Do not grasp on either good or bad. Letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go. That's the practice. Don't lean towards either purity or pollution. Don't lean towards either purity or pollution. Don't lean towards happiness or suffering. Don't choose one. I want to be happy. I want less suffering. I want to be peace. Don't lean towards suffering. Don't lean towards happiness. Now, just on this, when we practice object-based meditation, we get into samadhi, meaning into deep stages of concentration. So we might recite mu, or we might concentrate on just awareness of the breath. Okay, so there's an object of concentration. And the idea with an object of concentration is that we substitute anything else. We just concentrate on the one thing, and as that happens, we get into deeper stages of concentration. And then depending on how long you practice that and how deeply you go into it, you get into the jhanas, what they call the jhanas or dhyanas in Sanskrit, which is where the name Zen comes from. You know, jhana or Zen means jhanas or dhyanas. Okay. So that is one way of practicing. Okay. Now, we obviously get very peaceful because at that moment we experience no other. You know, at that moment there is just the object of concentration and there is no other. And we get a sense of that peace. Now, that is one kind of peace, but it is still, you know, in some sense a very shallow peace. Because as soon as we get out of jhana, this whole mind goes on again and does its discriminating and goes on and about and does all its thing. So we have this peace that we experience when we sit. But we need that peace as a foundation to start to get a taste for it, to start the foundation of concentration. Okay. So there is another peace, if you like. And the other piece is in our day-to-day life, when we are able to discriminate between peace and happiness and be able to let that go, when we can see that, oh, I'm moving towards this rather than this, and we are able to let go of that, that's when wisdom arises. That's when all of a sudden, within any context, no matter what happens, whether I'm happy or sad, I'm at peace. And I need to get to that point. That, like in when we practice Chikintatha, Chikintatha is objectless meditation, which comes later. I know some of you are practicing that already. So objectless meditation is when you don't have an object, you don't have a mu, or you don't have counting, or you don't have an awareness of the breath. You just sit with pure awareness. You need to have concentration to hold that, because at this stage you have got nothing that holds your awareness. No anchor point. You need to be able to have some ability to concentrate, to do it, you know. But it's just things arise as they arise. And that practice has the effect that we can move into another dimension, where as things happen to us, even in our day-to-day life, even in the traffic jam, in the midst of driving, where all of a sudden we can see all these formations that our mind is doing, we can see them and say, oh God, I'm just adding here. I've just had someone cut in. Okay, I determined that that is a bad thing. The next minute a swear word comes out of my mouth. The next minute I get angry. The next minute my emotions go. And all of a sudden I see all of that happening right in front of me. And when I see that happen, I can let it go because I understand it. I'm not attached. Because I've been practicing non-clinging, I'm not attached to it. I can let that go. And I let that go, and there's peace. So all of this can happen just like that, you know, from someone cutting me into me, having a smile on my face, because I can see it right there and then, right through all those steps. You know, that is another type of peace. We've got to get to that point as well. Not just sitting. And the question too is, you know, and I mentioned that to a few students, you know, those of you that are working on Mu, you know, don't just, you know, it's not just sitting and then getting Kensho. You need to really work on it. You know, work on it on a daily basis, and you can work on it in the traffic. It doesn't mean working on Mu doesn't mean that you have to sit all the time and just repeat Mu. You can repeat Mu in any stage in your life, or substitute Mu for just awareness, pure awareness. Read your own mind. That's what it's about. Reading the story of your own mind, and then recognizing your story and let go of the story. And bingo, you're right there. You know, so that's another way of looking at that. Do not grasp what is good, nor reject what is bad. That's what that is. Do not grasp what is good or reject what is bad. It's all neutral, and then we keep on adding good and bad. Don't lean towards either purity or pollution. Arrive at the empty nature of transgressions. Arrive at the empty nature of transgressions. You know, James and I were teaching forgiveness last week in prison. You know, this is really arrive at the, that's so hard. You know, one of the guys in prison, he said, you're teaching this to the wrong audience. Teaching forgiveness is so funny. But it is not easy. Arrive at the empty nature of transgressions. You know, any transgression, it's no bad, no good or bad. What creates good or bad is me. You know, that doesn't mean, of course, that we don't differentiate between good and bad. Of course we do. You know, but I can see it. I can know this is good, this is bad, but I'm totally at peace. I've transgressed it. It means that I am at peace with it. I see what we do, what humans do. Of course, what's happening in the Gaza or in Ukraine or all of that, I can say that's bad. But arriving at the empty nature of transgressions, you know, what's happening at the Gaza is nothing other than what's happening in my trees outside. I said to Diana the other day, look at those birds. All of a sudden we had new birds coming in. It's like a fight for territory. But there's a Gaza right in front of me. You would not have believed the shit fight that was happening right in front of my eyes, you know. Good and bad, you know, good and bad, you know. So this doesn't mean that we let go of good and bad in the sense that we don't have laws, we don't have precepts and all of that. But we get to the point where we see it very clearly, you know, for ourselves, for our own well-being. And for that to happen, we need to be able to let go. We need to be able to let go. Okay, don't lean towards either purity or pollution. Arrive at the empty nature of transgression, that nothing is attained through continuous thoughts. In other words, fixating through thoughts and trying to continuously validate or not validate, and this is better and that is better, and I should be doing it this way or that way. Nothing is attained through continuous thoughts. And that because there is no self nature, the three worlds, that should be worlds, desire, form, and formless, are only mind. So this is Buddhist cosmology. So the three worlds and the natures are only mind. In other words, everything we create through our mind. our history, our perceptions, you know, whatever cosmology part we believe in, whatever precepts we attach to or not attach to, it's all created in the mind. The myriad forms of the entire universe are the seal of the single Dharma. The myriad forms, so billions and billions of forms, they are the seal of the single Dharma. So, first of all, again, single Dharma, no separation. The seal, meaning the seal of the single Dharma, is like they are the validation of the single Dharma. And this is another way of saying form is emptiness and emptiness is form. They are the seal of the... So all these different forms that we see, all these perceptions, everything we see, they are the seal of the single Dharma. The single Dharma. We've got to see that single Dharma beyond forms and at the same time forms. Single Dharma. Whatever forms are seen are but the perception of mind. Keeps going. Whatever forms are seen are but the perception of mind. But mind is not independently existing. There's another one. But mind is not independently existing. You know. It is codependent with form. It is codependent for form. This comes back to that chair. The chair and mind are codependent. Buddha mind is codependent. Television and mind is codependent. Zoom and it's all codependent. It's not independently existing. You should speak appropriately about the affairs of your own life, for each matter you encounter constitutes the meaning of your existence. Please, after this meditation, take time and dwell on this. Not today, because you keep sitting, but this is really good. It keeps going. You should seek appropriately about the affairs of your own life, for each matter you encounter constitutes the meaning of your existence. So to give you an example of this, when I looked at it, you read it and you go, oh, okay, what does that mean? Yeah, what does that mean? Okay. I've got no money. I'm poor. There you go. If I think I've got no money, then the next thing that comes up is, oh, I'm poor. That's the meaning of my existence. Just because I don't have money, I now got this label, or I make myself this label, I'm poor. Or I got money and I'm rich. So I create the meaning of my existence all the time. You know, my monkey mind is nothing other than the meaning of my existence. You know. I watch the news. I get angry at the news. Or disappointed, or disillusioned. That's the meaning of my... There's form there, I listen to it. Next minute, emotions arise, or formations of mind arise because of it. I am continuously creating the meaning of my existence. Your mental life, that's what it is. Our mental life, we are continuously creating it. Our mental life, we are continuously creating it. And to think that this guy wrote this, you know, so long ago, for each, you know, you should seek appropriately about the affairs of your own life. For each matter you encounter constitutes the meaning of your existence. And your actions are without hindrance. What does that mean? Your actions are without hindrance. Actions is nothing other than meaning. I mean, there's only movement, and then whatever move, if I go like that, that's just a movement. But the meaning is, oh, I just punched someone. That's the meaning. So it's just, but there is no hindrance. What hinders is my mind. Oh, I can't punch someone. I can't do a prostration. I don't want to do that. These are the hindrances. My own mind. But there is no hindrance. Yeah. I can do whatever I want to do within the limits of physics, of course, you know. But I don't, because of my hindrances. And the hindrances are, it's, again, it's the mind. The mind is Buddha, Buddha is mind, you know. Encounter constitutes the meaning of your existence, and your actions are without hindrances. The fruit, goes on to say, of the Bodhisattva way is just thus. The fruit of the Bodhisattva is someone, we're all Bodhisattvas. A Bodhisattva is someone, Bodhi means awakened, Sattva is on the way. Or Sattva being, sorry, Sattva means being, okay, awakened being. Or someone that is on the way to, someone that is searching and trying to liberate themselves, in many ways falls under that category of Bodhisattva. Okay. So the fruit of the Bodhisattva, of, you could say practitioners, the fruit of practitioners, way, the Bodhisattva way, is just thus, born of mind, taking names to be forms. Born of mind, taking names to be forms. Because of the knowledge of the emptiness of forms, birth is non-birth. Now get your head around that one. Because of the knowledge of the emptiness of forms, birth is no birth. And, you know, this gets right to it. Yeah. And you heard me many times talk about it because we always get to it, you know. But it's not an easy thing to see. And every one of us has to keep on clarifying the matter. Because of the knowing of the emptiness of forms, birth is non-birth. So let me try and explain that again. So I could say that this sheet of paper here is impermanent. Why? Because it's right here is impermanence. Because it took a tree or topsoil or chemicals or whatever in the past to have produced it. So there's a symbol of impermanence already. So this sheet of paper is already impermanent. And you could also say this sheet of paper is death. Because a lot of things needed to die for this to appear. A lot of things needed to die for this to appear. So it's death, okay? I can say it's born. Okay, when is this sheet of paper being born? Okay, we can, maybe when it came out of the press, maybe, you know, we don't even know. When is it actually being born? Okay. When is it going to die? Okay, and this is, and birth, this is the thing. Birth is non-birth. In other words, death is non-death. Okay, birth is non-birth, and death is no death. Okay, I'm going to show you birth and death now. Okay, birth and death. In the context of what is meant here. So, by the way, for birth and death, for you to see this, birth and death, you need to get rid of the concept of time. If you're stuck in the past or the future or even the present, you know, that interferes. So for one moment, really believe there is no such thing as time. There is no presence. There is no past, no future, and the clock never stops. It keeps moving. You know, this is a concept that we have that we're so attached to. But we can move beyond it. We can see beyond this. Okay. So if I'm now going to kill this piece of paper, and I'm going to rebirth it, even though there's no such thing. But at what point I want you to look at what point is this dying, this piece of paper, and at one point is something else being created? Is it now? Is it past? Where's now? Where's the future? Where is it? That's the past. So don't go there. Don't go to the future. Hang on a little bit more. So is this now, when I now separated, is this the death? Or is the death here? Or was the death already there? When is it actually dying? Has it died? Is this now, I could say, oh, twins. I got twins. When did it die? It's right here. But no, 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 it's no longer there. It's twins. Born. Birth. Is it really dead? Death is a concept, and so is birth. We are looking at it like, hang on a second, I'm born and I die. Yeah. If you can get your head around that there is no such thing as time, again, you need to experience it, unfortunately. It's too difficult otherwise. There is no such thing as time. Everything happens simultaneously. It happens, everything we do, everything that happens in this universe is happening simultaneously. What comes out of my mind now is just, that's it. And then we say, oh no, that was in the past and that was in the future, and we've got twins now, and oh, that poor paper died, let's have a funeral and let's celebrate because we've got new birth. So understanding birthless or deathless is no separation. There's no separation. Of course, my body, exactly what happened to this piece of paper is going to happen to my body. Maybe a funeral, maybe this, maybe that. And all of that is happening to everyone's body. And our attachments, whether the attachments are past, present, or future, or the attachments are to, you know, I really like this person, or the attachment, whatever that, the attachment is what contributes to, you know, our being attached, which has got consequences, and those consequences more often than not are suffering. And the non-attachment, the consequences of that is liberation. Free. You know, that's the difference. So this is what I'm getting out of this. Where am I? Comprehend of this, one acts. Okay, because of the knowledge of the emptiness of forms. Because of the knowledge of the emptiness of forms, birth is non-birth. When I really see through form, birth is non-birth. Comprehending this, Matsu keeps on, or Basso keeps on saying, one acts in the fashion of one's time, just wearing clothes, eating food, constantly upholding the practices of the Bodhisattva, and passing time according to circumstances. So it's like everything has its, everything, all the circumstances have their place. So knowing this, we just go along with it. We just flow along with it and do everything according to the way it is occurring. Just like that. It's the way it is occurring. You know? And what gets in the way from the freedom and what gets away from non-suffering is, I don't want you to die, or I don't want this and I don't want that. All these attachments that we have. Then the last sentence, he says, if one practices in this manner, is there anything more to be done? Is there anything more to be done? It's just magic. So please savor this. It's kind of nice. Okay, then we have a commentary which is very succinct and a nice verse as well. So Mumon's commentary goes, if you grasp it on the spot, you wear Buddha clothes, eat Buddha food, speak Buddha words, do Buddha deeds. Just beautiful. You are Buddha himself. Or herself, or themselves, or itself. Many selves. You are Buddha himself. You are Buddha. Don't need any self. You are Buddha. Though this may be so, Dabai has, alas, misled not a few people into mistaking the mark on the balance for the weight itself. And that is what we do so often when we get stuck. You know, so this is a Dokusan question. How did he do that? Where is that mark? How can he realize that even the mere mention of the word Buddha should make a man rinse his mouth for 3 days? It's like a swear word. If you use the word Buddha, it's like a swear word. But it's a swear word if you don't see what Buddha is. If you get stuck on Buddha as a concept, it's a swear word. You know, that's what is Buddha? What is God? What is Chair? What is Ryan? What is Raf? You know, these are the questions. If one is such a man or woman, when he hears someone say, mind is Buddha, he will cover his ears and run away. Is cover his ears. I mean, nowadays I don't think you would run away, but you would have a good chuckle, you know. Like, you can't help but laugh, you know. If someone looks at Buddha that way, you can have a bit of a chuckle, you know. You're no longer swayed by language. Language has no longer got the hold. Language like Buddha or asshole, doesn't matter. It's got no longer got a hold. You see it for what it is. No separation. The verse. The blue sky, the broad daylight. It is most detestable to hunt around. If further you ask, what is Buddha? It is like shouting your innocence while holding the lute. So the blue sky, the broad daylight, refers to absolute clarity. Clarity of mind. So this is, if you like, if you've got complete clarity of mind, pure mind, if you like, pure mind. It is most detestable to hunt around. Why would you hunt around? No separation. In fact, there can't be any hunting around. There's no hunting, you know. It's most detestable to hunt around. Someone that hunts around is separated. They're hunting something. You are everything. You are everything. How can you hunt around? You know. If furthermore you ask, what is Buddha? You know, it is like shouting your innocence while holding the lute. You know, if you ask, what is Buddha? Of course, Basso, you know. Basso gave, this mind is Buddha. Or mind itself. Buddha itself. These are things we add. So don't be confused about this koan. Basso has added something to what is Buddha. What is Buddha? What is Buddha? What is Buddha? I'll leave you at that. What is Buddha?